Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Over the past few years, one of the hottest topics in the conversation that we're having now across the country on school reform and how public education might be improved, one of the hottest topics of conversation has been the charter school. Now, the supporters of charters argue a number of things. They say that these privately run but publicly funded schools give teachers and administrators the freedom to be more innovative. They argue that they give parents more choice, get parents more involved, and as a result, student achievement is improved, that students do better. This morning in this part of the show, we'll look at some of these claims, particularly that last one, and that is the assertion by a lot of people that student performance improves in charter schools, or at least if you compare the kids who are in the charters with kids who are in conventional public schools, that is, the charter students' performance is better. We'll examine that question this morning in this part of the program as we talk with Jack Buckley. He is affiliated research professor at the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education. That's at Columbia University. He is also adjunct professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute at Georgetown University. And he is the co-author of a book that's titled Charter Schools, Hope or Hype. It's published by the Princeton University Press and takes a look at research on charters, very specifically research that the authors did looking at charter schools in Washington, D.C. We'll talk about that and hopefully say some things that go beyond just the schools in Washington, D.C. And questions certainly are welcome. People who are listening are welcome to call with their questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So, again, locally, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they're brief so that we can keep moving along, but anybody is welcome to call. And we'll say hello to our guest, Professor Buckley. Hello.
David, glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much. We appreciate you giving some of your time. First, let me ask you a very basic question.
Sure.
How many charter schools are there now in the United States?
I'd say right now there's just under about 4,000.
Okay.
Which adds up to pretty close to a million kids.
And that is quite a significant increase in the number, I think, in your book that you say that maybe in 1995 there were maybe 100. So that's over that period of time, that's quite a significant increase in the number of charters.
Yes. I mean, the first charter school, the first chartering law was passed in 1991. And since then, you know, we've seen from, which was in Minnesota, since that first state, there's now just 40 states plus the District of Columbia, and the numbers have grown really quite quickly. Mm. Although there are some signs that they're flattening out a bit, as a lot of states have hit mandatory caps. For example, a lot of the chartering laws placed a cap on the number of schools or the proportion of students.
Mm-hmm. I think with as much as discussion there is of charter schools, and we do, as I said, I think there are certainly they have their advocates, and there are many communities where people have either set them up or have talked about setting them up. As much as that all is true, I think probably there will be some people who still will not be sure what a charter school is or what makes charter school different from the other public school in town, the one that's been there forever. Is there a very basic way in which you would define a charter school?
Well, I think you hit on the key part right there, which is that a charter school is still a public school. And so very different from a lot of other school reforms, particularly the idea of giving vouchers for people to go to private schools. You know, a charter school remains part of the state's public school system, but typically will have a great deal more autonomy, both perhaps in hiring and firing of teachers, in setting of curriculum, programmatic decisions, longer school days. They have a lot more flexibility and freedom to set their own policies and procedures, but they do remain a public school.
And they still have to answer to the administrators of that district, just like any other public school.
Most of the time, again, the laws vary across states. They absolutely always have to answer to somebody. Mm-hmm. Sometimes for a variety of reasons, it's taken out of the hands of the folks in that district, and maybe they report to a state office. And it's also important to note they are accountable for the state testing under No Child Left Behind, just like the public schools.
Mm-hmm. So that's, I guess, in my mind, that was one of the questions that I was a little uncertain about, and that is that there's still, because accountability, and this is something I'm sure we'll talk about, accountability is still a big issue for people, and that somehow they argue that charters are more accountable. They may or they may not be. But the bottom line is here is that indeed, yes, they still do have to answer to somebody. As you say, it might not be the district superintendent. It might be somebody at the next level up in administration in that state. But at some point, yes, they have to answer to somebody.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting to note also that charter schools, to some extent, they really do predate the current wave of educational accountability reform, particularly state testing. Mm-hmm. So while now one might wonder whether or not charter schools are accountable, originally the intention was to drive the promotion of these accountability reforms by creating this class of schools that was more accountable than the public schools.
What, briefly, do so suppose within a community you have a group of individuals who are interested in starting a charter school. What do you have to go through to do it? Who may do it?
Again, there's a lot of variation in the chartering laws from state to state. So, for example, some states will have a single chartering authority, while others will have set up several, which usually tends to make it easier. You know, we found, not in this particular study, but we found evidence in the past that sort of, you know, common sense evidence, the easier you make multiple pathways would increase the number of charters. Typically, there'll be, you know, some authorizing agency, and the people who are interested in creating a school will have to put together a plan and get it approved by that agency. They'll have to show that they're able to fund the school in the early years and provide facilities. And that plan will also have to include the accountability provisions. Usually the state law will say typically 5 years, you know, a five-year initial period after which that school's performance should be reviewed to see whether or not the charter can be renewed.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the fact that one of the things you have to keep in mind is that unlike other private schools that might be available to people, the charter school is still a public school. How does the funding work? And do they still get their per pupil funding basically the same as the other public school in town, or is there something here that's different?
Another good question. Again, there's variation by state. In general, there is a per pupil amount which will travel with, say, a student leaves a traditional public school and goes to the charter. That dollar amount will go with them. Certainly, I've seen in some states they had, especially in the early years of implementation, had sort of a sliding scale where maybe the charter school did not get 100% of that per pupil amount. And Massachusetts comes to mind. I remember I think they had sort of three levels at which the funding sort of progressed until ultimately it reached 100%. Mm-hmm. There's also a bit of contention in some states whether or not that amount really is the full amount that the public schools get, and especially this comes up in the issue of facilities, where a lot of the public schools are really not required to pay a great deal of maintenance or the sort of the depreciation cost of their buildings, whereas a new charter school might get the per pupil amount the same as the public schools, but also have to put a great deal of additional outlay on buildings and facilities maintenance.
So they have to come up with a building to have their school in somehow.
Often, yeah. So now some in districts that have been more amenable to charter schools, they might actually give sort of unused or you know, buildings that might need some renovation but belong to the school district. But other districts have fought that and have made it much more difficult for the charters to come up with space. Yeah. And this is a perennial problem for charter schools, is to keep facilities.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, one of the things that you mentioned, apparently there are some places where, yes, they do provide this per pupil funding like the public school, but that there are some places where they actually would give the charter school less money per pupil than they would give the public school, and that embedded in that is this idea that somehow the charter school is more efficient and that you can get the same kind of education, deliver the same kind of education. Some people would make the argument that you could even deliver a better education for less money, so that somehow that's used some places as a justification for giving less money to the charter school than you do to the public school.
I would say that was probably true in the past. It's certainly true that that's been one of the justifications, especially in the early years of charter schools, that somehow they would be more efficient. The competitive forces of the market would be unleashed, and not only would they potentially be more efficient, but they would make the surrounding districts more efficient as they competed for students. I would say probably by now most states, if not all, are offering or are required to provide the full per pupil amount. Mm. So that's less of a rationale for sort of doing that now, but the that underlying efficiency argument certainly remains. That's certainly true.
Very quickly, let me just introduce again for anybody who might have tuned in, our guest, Jack Buckley. He's affiliated research professor at the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education. That's at Columbia University. He is also adjunct professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute at Georgetown and is the co-author of a book that looks at charter schools and closely looks at charter schools in Washington, D.C. The title of the book is Charter Schools, Hope or Hype, and it is published by the Princeton University Press. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me just ask one more kind of basic question, then we have a caller here we will get in.
Sure.
I mentioned that if you try to describe what charter schools are like, particularly if you ask someone who is an advocate of charter schools, what's a charter school all about, they will say, well, partly what this is about is giving teachers and administrators the freedom to do different sorts of things, to influence different aspects of the curriculum, to teach in different ways, to do different things with the kids, and that creativity is all to the good. Will result in students doing better. At the same time, they also say that an important feature of the charter school is accountability, and that's one of the big buzzwords in public education these days, you know, that schools, we're putting more and more pressure on schools to demonstrate that their teaching is effective and that students do perform, and that's why we have so much high-stakes testing. One might, though, say that in a strange and an interesting way, those two goals, the autonomy on the one hand and the accountability on the other, seem like they might be in conflict. Do people in either looking at charters or who work within that world see that there is some potential for conflict between those two goals, between accountability and autonomy?
I think that's certainly true. There are a variety of reasons why people support charter schools, and one of the most interesting things about charter school ed reform is that it has such a sort of diverse bunch of supporters. And certainly, some of the initial support came from education reformers, think tanks, people who were trumpeting the accountability reform, tied in with the efficiency that you brought up earlier. But related to that, the autonomy folks, especially if they're really looking to carve out a school that's very, very different from the traditional public schools in their area, they tend to find that while they recognize that accountability is important, I think the conflict really starts to come into play here, where they would really like, for example, for their school to have a little bit longer time to meet some of these targets, given that they feel that their school is unique or has become sort of so autonomous or so different from the rest of the schools in the district. That maybe its standards should be different, and given that something we mentioned earlier, given that the entire country is sort of caught up in terms of accountability reform, and now the charter schools aren't so unique, I think that also highlights the tension that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some people who are listening here. We have a couple. They're both here in Urbana, where we are. We'll start with someone on line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. One. It seems to me that in our local area, a town not far from here, they had a charter school, and there was, and I don't remember this well, it was in Decatur, and I think they had a lot of irregularities about how the money was being spent. And I hope somebody will call and kind of refresh my mind how the Decatur Charter School went. The other, I was wondering, across the nation, what kind of students? Is it students that are perpetually not doing well in school, or people who are wanting to challenge really bright kids and think they're not being challenged? So I'll hang up and listen on those two questions. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, two great questions. I'll take them in order if I can. I don't know a lot about the particular school in Decatur. I did check, get a chance to take a look at the Illinois State website, and I know there still is one charter school in Decatur called the Robertson Charter School. So at least as of the school year, they were filed as still operating, but I don't know any other details about that. But you did mention this issue of irregularities, and I think that's a really important point. I think we mentioned in the book something like approximately 15% of all the charter schools that have opened to date have been closed for a variety of reasons. And one of the most interesting things that we've seen here is most of the schools that have been closed until only very recently were closed because of usually some sort of financial irregularities or something, some kind of impropriety. And only recently have there started to have been some closures of charter schools more to do with the fact that they failed to meet the targets in their charter and that are actually in the plan. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, again, if they were given 5 years, they were only just now, just in the last couple of years, actually hitting that target date. But it's important to note that a lot of these schools have been closed over some impropriety, usually financial.
Just to go to the second question, I think that's a very interesting one. And in the book, this is one of those questions that when you took a close look at the schools in Washington, D.C., you were trying to answer. And that is, if you take a look at the students, that you know, describe them, their demographics, who they are, what sort of baggage they bring with them, metaphorically speaking, to school. If you look at the schools, the students that are in the public schools, and then you take a look at the students that are in the charter schools, and you try to make some comparison. The question being, are the charter school students really different from the students in the public schools? Interestingly enough, at least according to the work you did looking at Washington, D.C., and I don't know what you can say about schools across the country, it seemed the answer is no, not really.
I think that's true. Certainly, as you said, in Washington, D.C., we found that the kids in the charter schools were more likely to be poor, to be eligible for free or reduced price lunch, really no difference in education, and less likely to be English language learners. That reflects Washington, D.C., although similar things have been found in New York and elsewhere. More interesting, we thought, was beyond those sort of really broad demographic categories, we were curious whether or not there were any differences in the kids' peer groups, in other sort of things that are a little bit harder to measure at a level without without really getting into some survey research. And that's where we really found, again, in D.C., no difference. So in terms of what the highest grade they expected to attain, how often they talk with their parents about school, the proportion of their friends who like school or get good grades or use bad language or get in trouble, sort of some peer group measures. In D.C., we didn't find any difference on those.
This, I think that it gets to this issue, and I think that people have raised the same kind of question when you're talking about the dynamic between public and private schools, this concern that the charters would skim off the best students, the most desirable students, the ones that are highest performing, come from homes where parents are most motivated about children to do well, and that will just create more difficulties for the public schools because the kids who are tougher to educate for a variety of reasons, they will stay in the public schools, and the kids who are the learning racehorses, they're going to be in the charters. And you looked at that as well, and it looks as if the answer to that is, well, actually, no, that's not happening either.
Again, I would say, given the population that we looked at in similar populations, that it's hard to sustain the argument that the charter schools are skimming the best kids. Now, again, we should step back, though, from a global perspective. Most charter schools tend to be in urban school districts where, on average, the kids have a lot more going on with their lives and are harder to educate than kids in the wealthy suburbs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, in Illinois, for example, there's only a handful of charter schools that are outside of Chicago. And even most of those, of that small handful, are in places like East St. Louis. There are very few, if any, I think maybe three or four charter schools that are not in a, you know, sort of in a concentrated urban district. But then once within those districts, again, we find sort of little difference on some of the measures that we're able to gather between the kids in the traditional schools and the charter schools.
Well, let's go on and talk with someone else here. And this is also someone in Urbana on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have two questions. One is about the attitude of teachers' unions toward charter schools. And traditionally, teachers' unions have been very negative toward charter schools because they thought that they lessened the security and treatment of teachers in them. But there was an article recently, this past week, I believe, in the New York Times, which seemed to indicate that, at least in a certain area, teachers had become more accommodating, teachers' unions had become more accommodating and more open to the idea of charter schools. Would you like to address that before I ask the second question?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right in that historically, most of the teachers' unions, both the locals and the two large national confederations, did oppose charter school reform and have opposed most school choice reform for the reasons you mentioned. I think we're getting to the point where charter school reform is so widespread, it's pretty clear it's not going to go away, and that the teachers' unions are realizing it may or may not be. It certainly doesn't seem to be a threat to most of them, most of their operations. And in the concentrated urban areas where charter school reform is the densest, it's building such popular support that it may not be in their best interest to continue to oppose it. Certainly in Washington, we've seen increasing bipartisan support for charter school reform. It's the consensus, again, seems to be that these schools are not doing anything wrong, and in some areas are really providing some meaningful choices for parents. And I think that the union's shifting position reflects that.
I see. Okay, the second question I have is the difference between charter schools and magnet schools. And this may be directed more to the high school level, I'm not sure. But I wonder, particularly in the area of vocational education that I'm interested in, I wondered if you could say something about whether the magnet school, and maybe even below the high school level or the middle school level, whether the magnet school couldn't do the same thing that the charter school could do and thus avoid, you know, any residual antagonism of teachers' unions.
I think that's an interesting idea. Certainly there are fewer charter schools operating at the secondary school level, mostly just because it's much harder to start a high school than it is in elementary school, say. The magnet school reform, of course, was created largely as a desegregation measure, right? So the idea was to create a sort of a special purpose high school, usually high school, sometimes sort of a joint middle high school, that would attract kids from all over sort of a greater metropolitan area and get them to break down some of the color lines and actually provide a, because they were providing a programmatic education that a wide variety of kids would be interested in. They typically didn't and don't have as much autonomy as the charter schools do. And charter schools, again, aren't usually set up for the same purpose. But all that said, there is probably a good deal of overlap there. And there's no reason why, in a particular area, why magnet schools and charter schools couldn't work together. And maybe, you know, there is more and more overlap, I think, too, as more charter schools expand into the secondary years.
Well, could you say anything about the comparative effectiveness of the charter school path as opposed to the magnet school path?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I guess it depends on what you're measuring. The magnet schools, I think, have had a limited but positive success in terms of their desegregation objective in some areas. Whether or not they, I'm not familiar with research on whether or not, for example, you know, kids have higher achievement score growth or something in the magnets versus the surrounding schools. Uh-huh. Somebody should probably look at that now that, again, given that the accountability world has changed a great deal. My guess is that performance-wise is probably about the same. The difference would be sort of parent satisfaction or whether or not parents in the local communities really thought that they were getting something new in the magnet schools or if they thought they were just getting traditional public schools repackaged.
Okay. Let me ask if there's time, David. I don't know.
Sure, go ahead.
One further question. My cousin taught in an elementary school in Chicago. And I can mention the name of the school. It's Pierce School on the north side of Chicago. And what happened there was the teacher, who was a bilingual teacher, and it's a largely Latino school, was given permission to change the name of the school from Pierce Elementary School to Pierce School of International Studies. And there was a lot of bilingual teaching going on, both in Spanish and in English. That permitted her to change the staff, to get rid of teachers she thought were underperforming. Just that name change, because it was declared a new school.
Right.
To start from scratch. Is that common, or is that and by the way, it's been used as a model school by the city of Chicago. When people from abroad come over, they often take delegations there. Is that a move that's being made elsewhere, or is that something just very unique?
I'm certainly not sure about the sort of the prevalence of renaming schools. I do know, you know, for example, it's very hard to find a lot of public schools that close or go away. And when they do, it tends to be, you know, something maybe 4% on the average, on the order of 4% a year. And when they do, they're often renamed, maybe broken up or combined or renamed. I think that the most interesting point there is an important one, is that, you know, charter schools do not have a monopoly on education innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a lot of other things going on in school districts and you know, which have been for a long time. And perhaps more importantly, a lot of the so-called innovation that the charter schools introduce is really often the same things that other district schools have done, have tried and found to be successful. So, I mean, I think it is quite common that non-charter schools are innovating all the time and trying to find ways to deliver better public education to their kids.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is Jack Buckley. He is affiliated research professor at the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education, which is at Columbia University. He's also adjunct professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute at Georgetown and is the co-author of a book titled Charter Schools, Hope or Hype. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Looks at the issue of charter schools and very closely at charter schools in Washington, D.C. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about your looking at the schools in Washington and looking at the students in the charter schools and making some comparison between those students and the students in the public schools, with an eye to asking this question, are the students really different? And the answer you come back with is, no, they're really not particularly different. It's really very much the same student population, and that there's probably good reason to say that in other big, as far as we can tell, in other big metropolitan areas, you'd find the similar situation, that is, the kids in the charters would be very much like the kids in the public schools. If you then turn, as you did, and took a look at the parents of the students and compared the parents of the students in the charter schools with the parents of the students in public schools and tried to ask, again, some basic questions about them, about who they are, about whether or not they consider education important, how much they are involved in their children's education, how much they are involved in the school. You ask all those kinds of questions. Are the charter school parents different substantially from the public school parents?
Well, you know, this is, again, a very important question. because we know how important parents are to all educational outcomes with kids. We were particularly interested in looking at how parents search for information about schools, because in order for charter school theory to work as promised, parents really need to be actively out there searching to figure out what school would best match their kids' interests and which schools have better facilities, test scores, whatever it is that the parents are interested in. And we did find certainly some evidence, as you'd expect, that the parents of charter school kids did a lot more active searching. They were really out there looking for more information about the schools. And we found evidence that when they actually acquired that more information, it was more likely to lead them to change their kid's school. So they're by that measure would appear to be more involved in those aspects of their child's education, which suggests they may be more motivated in other ways as parents.
So there does seem to be that maybe if the students really aren't that different, that maybe one difference here is the parents, and that perhaps the charters are drawing in parents who are maybe a little bit more motivated, are a little bit more interested in being involved in their children's education, are concerned that the quality of education in the public schools is not what it should be. So maybe in that respect, can you say that that benefit of the charters that charter advocates argue really is the case?
Well, so this was what makes it so important if you're going to try and do a study to assess really any kind of benefits in trying to ascribe them to charter schools, but particularly academic ones. You obviously need to take that problem into account, the fact that the parents are likely to be self-selected to some extent. Mm. And actually, there's a very interesting study that came out this week, New York City Charter Schools, by Carolyn Hoxby, an economist who's moving to Stanford this year. And they used something that we actually tried to do in a few chapters here as well, the fact that since most of these charter schools tend to be oversubscribed and that too many kids are trying to get into them, mm-hmm. they use a lottery to assign the seats. And once you've done that, now you've got a random assignment mechanism where all the parents were equally motivated to sort of search out the school and apply, but only some of them were randomly able to get in. And we do that in some of the chapters, for example, when we look at parent satisfaction. We had another subset of kids whose parents had applied to charter schools but didn't get in. And these types of studies, I think, are really the strongest at trying to get around that bias that you bring up, which otherwise we wouldn't be able to disentangle, or it would be very difficult to.
Just to get back to something that I didn't get to touch on earlier, that is the question: can charters refuse to admit a child? Mm. Is it more the case that they have so many seats, and when those seats are filled, then they have to tell people, "Well, I'm sorry, but we've don't have any more room"? Or are there some reasons up front for a charter to do something that the public school cannot do, and that is to say to a parent, "I'm sorry, but we will not admit your child"?
In most states, they don't have any extra ability beyond those of the public schools to not admit a child up front, although sometimes there are exceptions depending on if the kid has a particular disability and whether or not they're set up to accommodate that. Now, that said, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, and it's not something we really look into because it's very hard to measure, but that charter schools maybe are a little bit more active than traditional public schools in getting kids out of them once they've showed up and started to be a problem. Hmm. And, you talk to enough teachers in an urban district or charter school operators, and you start to hear stories about them counseling kids out, October, November, after they've got lotteried in, but have turned out to be a real problem. And that would tend to be more common, I guess, than the public schools, where there's really that's virtually impossible to do. Yeah. Now, again, I don't have any evidence of that, but that's certainly one of these anecdotal things that you hear about the schools. But no, in general, the charter schools across the board tend to be oversubscribed, and they will use a lottery, but they don't have any other particular powers to refuse kids.
Okay. Let's talk with another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I know this has changed, maybe the topic a little bit, but what's the trend been in private schools other words, have they been increasing? Have they been, you know, it just seems to me that I just wonder whether about public education in general. I mean, it's not being supported. Years we've been talking about, you know, in the inner city and all that kind of stuff, they had to get a better education, all that kind of thing. What's happening in this state at the college level is that the students are paying more and more of their, you know, education, that kind of thing. So if these trends continue, you know, what about public education? And it seems to me that some people, the only alternative they have sometimes is to send their kids to private school. So what's going to happen in the future?
Well, I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, public school enrollment trends, I don't have off the top of my head. Generally, what we see, though, is of course, they're correlated with the economy in the sense that when things get a little tougher, the private school enrollments tend to dry up, particularly at the lower levels, at the elementary and middle school levels. And I think there's a bit of that going on right now, actually. That said, I mean, regarding charter schools, one of the things that opponents said, but probably proponents said too, honestly, was that these are free private schools. Now, that's, of course, not exactly true, but there was a lot of concern by private school operators during the early years of charter reform that these kids would be coming out of their private schools and going to these charter schools instead. And I have seen some evidence of that. Again, Massachusetts comes to mind, where a lot of the Catholic schools in Boston, say, in Worcester, some of the other dioceses, saw that they were losing kids to these new charter schools because they were cheaper, and it was an economic form of competition where the parents who had put them, say, in a parochial school, not for the religious aspects but just for the instructional aspects or for some other reason, say discipline or uniforms, were finding substitute charter schools at much lower cost. And so I think that's a tension you'll see in a lot of areas, especially where there's a lot of charter competition, that some of the parents may view these as a substitute for private schools.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to get to the question that I suppose is the big question that we really haven't talked about so far, and that is this, that advocates of charter schools will argue, for a variety of reasons, and we've touched on some of the features that they think are important, they will argue that students in charter schools perform at a higher level than do students in public schools. Is that the case?
Again, that's the question, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That study by Hoxbee that I mentioned a few minutes ago actually provides probably the best evidence to date. Again, this is in New York City, but where they're primarily focused on academic outcomes. And what she finds is, on average, after a year, the charter school kids have grown about a tenth of a standard deviation more in math than the private school counterparts, and about half that in reading, which I think if you look at the sort of the New York State test, this is about 3 points or so on the test. So it's some evidence on average that there's a bit of an achievement bump. It's really not overwhelming in scope. When we look at D.C., again, our primary focus is not on academic outcomes, but we do look a bit and don't find really any evidence of a difference. If anything, there's a bit of a smaller average test score in the charter schools. Now, let's assume that Hoxbee's evidence is right. I think the interesting question is why. So mm-hmm. What is it about the charter schools that, you know, what are they doing right if they're doing something at all, if there is this benefit? And they can't get into it too much. But when they try and disentangle this, one of the things I thought was most interesting is one of the only reforms within the charter school that they find a statistical support for contributing to this benefit is actually a longer school year. So taking a step back, that doesn't strike me as overwhelming evidence really in favor of the charter schools regarding academic achievement. If really there's a small benefit and it's mostly driven by a longer school year, it's not clear that you would need a great deal of autonomy to provide that reform.
Yeah. Well, I guess that would, what you would want to ask this question, well, what, you know, given the fact that the idea is very appealing and that they may have some innovative ways of going about what they do. And you might be able to see in some small way that parents were a little bit more motivated to be putting their own effort into their kids' school experience. What, you know, why is it that charter schools don't do better? I mean, you would think that they have a lot of things going for them. And it seemed like for a long time, we really didn't have a good answer to this question. In part, perhaps because the people in the charters weren't all that forthcoming about with providing the data, or they didn't, you know, they didn't do it in ways that made it easy to analyze. So for a while, we really didn't have an answer to that question. Do kids in the charters do better? Well, now we're starting to get some answers. And in some cases, we're saying, no, they don't. In some cases, we're saying, well, maybe, yes, they do, but it's pretty small. You'd have to think, though, that the idea of the charter was pretty good, and wonder why it is that it doesn't have more of a bump than it does, apparently.
Well, I mean, I guess a good reason for that might be something we've mentioned, just the idea that these charter schools, they tend to be drawing from a sort of creating a bundle of existing reforms, many of which are also being enacted in the traditional schools at the same time sometimes even. Mm-hmm. So the longer school day, longer school year, uniforms, discipline, themes, particular thematic elements of the curriculum. And so to some extent, you know, short of the deeper structural autonomy questions, a lot of what they do is very similar, and they're doing it with the same population. So seeing, you know, frankly, be quite surprised to see a really large difference. I mean, stepping back a bit, though, the idea of charter school reform is really a systemic reform. And to some extent, maybe the right question is, or the right level to be looking at the effects is the systemic level. So, for example, some of the market proponents of charter school reform would say, if all the kids' test scores were the same, but the system was able to provide education cheaper, then charter schools would be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of a productivity dimension. Also, other proponents of charter schools advance the argument that they'd be driving more and more competition in the local traditional schools. So again, then you would think that would drive the academic performance to be the same. So to some extent, these people, you know, somebody from this school would advocate or ascribe overall success in the district to the introduction of charter school reform, even if there were a few differences between the schools or among the schools.
Hmm. It's something that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about, and we're coming down here to about our, you know, about our last 5 minutes or so, is the basic idea that underlies school choice. And the argument is, you know, something like this. They people will argue that it really hasn't been, you know, the fact that public schools, generally speaking, in most communities, have a corner on the market of education, hasn't really been very good either for public schools or students. There always would have been opportunities for some people to put their kids in private schools, but right, not everybody has that kind of resources, and so most people are going to send their children to the public school. And as you know, we've talked about earlier, the public school must take all comers. They can't refuse to educate a child. If that child lives in the district, you've got to take that child. And the argument has been that that's really hasn't been very good for schools or kids. But that if you bring in the idea of market competition and you create a situation where schools will be competing for students and that parents will be able to choose among a variety of schools, then the argument is that kind of competition among the schools for students will force them to do a better job, to get rid of bad teachers or to look at their curricula or, you know, whatever. They will be a little bit tougher in looking at what it is they do and maybe making changes for the better. So that's the idea behind giving parents choice, and whether it's magnet schools or whether we're going to throw charters in there or whatever, to say to the parents, you choose where your child will go. Is there any evidence that shows that giving parents choice actually does what advocates of choice argue that it will do?
Well, I mean, I think this is this is certainly the point of our project, is to try and look sort of one by one at as many of the different benefits of choice that advocates had claimed in D.C. to see whether or not there was any truth to that. And I think this is certainly one of the driving themes of the broader research in this whole area. I would also add, you mentioned private schools, that there's another very important form of school choice that some people have access to, which is residential choice. That, you know, arguably Americans who can afford to move for schools do, and certainly at key milestones in their child's education will make a move. You know, we're all familiar with people who have moved out of a city as their kids have gotten close to five to put them in a suburban school system, and at those key points, either that or a new job, parents who are mobile in that way will spend a lot of effort researching the school systems. And you know, talking about real estate, prices to some extent are driven by the quality of schools, and there's a good bit of research supporting that. But in terms of the broader question about whether or not sort of school choice delivers what is promised, I think the jury's still out. The we find evidence that parents seem to be more satisfied. You know, they report that they're happier with their schools. Although, as they've been in them for longer periods of time, that tends to converge on the traditional kids. We don't really look at productivity. That's extremely hard to measure in terms of whether or not the whole system has gotten cheaper for everybody because of choice. Some economists have tried to tackle that. I don't think there's a consensus on that dimension.
Hmm.
And whether or not there's a growth in test scores over time, again, is tricky. Actually, that economist I mentioned earlier, Carolyn Hawksby, had another paper in the 90s about looking at urban districts overall, trying to show that having more choice led to some sort of increase in test scores. That was a pretty compelling result for a while, although there's been some controversy about it. There was somebody else who was not able to replicate her results. So I'd say that question's still open, and it gets pretty hard to measure.
Another one of the things that you look at, and again, this may be a difficult question to answer, but you know, this idea of market competition improving quality of education by giving parents choice somehow implies that parents will indeed do comparison shopping, in a sense. You know, they'll go and they'll look, okay, and they'll say, these are the potential schools that I might choose to send my child to, and what I want to do is look closely at each one and their performance and what the kids are like and what the emphasis is and what kind of education my child will receive, and then, based on all of this research and careful thought, I'm going to decide which one my child will go to. Do parents actually do that? And even if they decided they wanted to do that, how easy or difficult would it be to do that?
Right. That's absolutely essential. So no market for schooling is going to function without parents having access to and using information. Absolutely. So some of the early theorists of school choice claimed that parents, the existence of choice would drive parents to do that all by themselves. And we certainly have not found that to be true. I would say in a lot of areas it's very hard for parents to find good evidence about the schools, and that probably not enough of them do. One of the components of this research that we write about in this particular book was we created a website in Washington, D.C. To collate, you know, sort of collect all this evidence in one place. And again, this was before the No Child Left Behind reforms really created a lot more information out there, where now you can find a website about schools in every state and just about every district. At the time, that was a lot harder to find. But, you know, that said, again, even given the existence of some of these things, it's very clear that not all parents will use the information. And that's hard. That's a tough barrier to overcome.
Hmm. Just real quick, and unfortunately we just have about a minute left. You were talking earlier about the fact that there's a study, and it was looking, I think it was, you said it was New York, looking at charters and public schools, finding that the kids in the charters did slightly better than the kids in the public schools, and that they're really about the only thing in terms of what it is they're doing, the only thing that you can point to that seems to be contributing to that effect is that the kids in the charter schools are spending more time in school. They have a longer school year. Given all of the different things that different schools, public schools, have tried to do, changes they've tried to make to perform, increased student performance. Has there been anything that one could point to and say, here is one reform, one change, one way we're doing things differently that we can actually demonstrate results in higher performance, other perhaps than having the children in school longer?
Well, there's been a lot of controversy about class size reduction. There is some good experimental evidence that in the younger grades that leads to more academic achievement. You know, if you can break the kids down into smaller classes. However, when we've seen people try and implement that at scale, like for example in California, they run into some other problems, primarily with the teacher labor market. You know, if you try and shrink all the classes by hiring a lot more teachers, you're going to run out of good teachers. So rarely is there sort of one simple reform that you could implement if you don't think about the broader picture, and it gets pretty hard. I would say, you know, certainly the longer school year, the more time on task tends to be correlated, all else equal, with academic achievement. And teachers are central. I mean, you need to have highly qualified teachers who are motivated and excited to teach their subjects and are qualified to do it. And that's hard because it takes money. I mean, the largest expense always in education is people, and teachers drive most of that, you know, 60-70% most places.
Yeah.
So keeping a pool of qualified teachers and getting them into your schools that need them most, which is really the hardest part, I think is really the most important reform of all.
All right. Our guest in this hour, Jack Buckley, affiliated research professor at the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education at Columbia University. He's also adjunct professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute at Georgetown University and a co-author of the book Charter Schools, Hope or Hype, published by the Princeton University Press. Professor Buckley, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.